Around the middle of May of this year, there was this video circulating of a Syrian rebel cutting out the heart of his enemy and eating it, while his comrades at arms stood by and cheered, "God is good. God is great." And it's such an horrific piece of video that, although you can find it and view it if you want online, most of the major news agencies chose not to show it, which seemed like an almost extraordinary burst of good sense in our culture. But when we hit a story like that, I think one of the questions that surfaces for us is what kind of person would do that? You know? And the stock answer is a monster. That's sort of the simple answer. It's the kind of language that often gets used to describe people that would perpetuate that kind of disturbing behavior, who would practice it. It's interesting language because, among other things, it suggests that the kind of person that would do something like that is a person that is entirely unlike me or you. That it's somebody that we could never understand, and by implication, we could never be like. And that is a comforting thought, because the alternative is that the kind of person who could do something like that isn't born that way. Might mean that I could do something like that. What I mean by that is that there's this whole other realm of possibility, which is that although there are some people who unquestionably arrive in the world with a bent to evil that is so substantial that it doesn't seem to matter what their circumstances are, they will be and do what is evil, it also seems likely that most of the people who do things that are atrocious and evil are taught to do so. So in other words, a substantial part of the answer to the question, what kind of person would do something like that, is an ordinary one that has been trained to. The guy that I mentioned in the blurb this week, and if you don't know what the heck I'm talking about the blurb, we communicate a lot of what happens here, what's going to happen here through email, and there is an email list. If you're not on it and you want to be, you can talk to anybody that you know to be a regular here, and they will direct you to the person who can add you to that list most efficiently. But so every week I sort of write a little something about where we're headed in terms of this part of our gathering. And I mentioned a gentleman in the blurb this week, a guy named James Dawes. Dawes is an English prof. He's also the director of the program in human rights at McAllister College in North Dakota, I think. And he just published a book called Evil Men. Really interesting book. What Dawes did in the process of researching this book is he kind of started with the idea that the people that we could learn the most about atrocity from are the people who have committed atrocities. So we kind of stay out of the realm of the theoretical. We're just going to get right into the thick of it. And the group of people that he chose, partly because of their age and their ability to continue to articulate their experience, was a group of Chinese folks who had been part of just visiting vicious atrocity on the East in the 40s and 50s, and so now they're grandfathers, but still very able to communicate and relate.
Japanese,
on the Chinese. Yes, thank you. And so he went and spent time with these folks and built relationship with them and hung out with them and their families and their kids and their grandkids and had conversations with them about what they had done and how they came to do it. Fascinating idea. I want to read you his summary of the process of making someone a monster. So he begins with the presupposition that we've already talked about. Monsters are made. This is how you make them. First, take a man. Yes, it is most often a man. And isolate him. Separate him from his family and friends and put him in an information bubble. An echo chamber cut off from the outside world. Make him conform to the values of his new group by exploiting his insecurity and need for approval. This is the first step in any war. Second, train him to think that the world is painted in black and white, not shades of gray. Train him in either or binary thinking. Either you are my friend or my enemy. Either you are pure or impure. Either the people you love are safe or they are in immediate peril. Either you are all right or you are all wrong. Third, physically exhaust him. Break down his body and spirit through brutal training or prolonged combat until he can't think straight. Subject him to a system of harsh and arbitrary punishment and equally arbitrary awards. Condition him to feel helpless. A man who feels like he has lost control over his life is a dangerous man because hurting others feels like control. Fourth, and this is the most important part, start small. Work up to atrocity step by step. Put him into a strange and frightening environment with minimal regulation. Let the aggression escalate. Each violent act he commits while trying to survive will make the next act feel easier, more natural. The first time he kills a villager, it is terrifying. The second time, it is hard. The third or fourth time, it starts to feel almost easy. Eventually, he finds himself competing with his fellow soldiers to see who can do it fastest, most often, most creatively. Watching videos like this, writes Dawes, and he's referring to this one about the Syrian rebel, and thinking thoughts like this, it is easy to lose hope. In war, are we doomed always to descend into barbarism? That is fascinating, and it's disturbing, at least to me. And this next bit, I realized as I was writing it down the other day, I just thought, this might just sound outrageous or even silly to you, I don't know. But part of what made this disturbing to me was how quickly it brought to mind far too many instances of my own religious experience. I'm grateful that that experience has not included training in committing brutally atrocious acts. But there are some ideas in there with which there is way too much resonance for me. And they include the ideas of isolation, the insistence about conforming to the values of the group, surrounding the individual with like-minded and like-actioned persons in exclusive ways, binary either-or thinking, the idea of smaller ideas leading to larger, more outrageous, less tenable ideas. Those kind of shapes of subculture have a more benign but a still dangerous shape, I would contend, in what we sometimes call the Christian ghetto. That kind of language is often referring to a way of life that has almost no influences in it, other than those that bear the label Christian in the Christian realm. I recall at one point somebody trying to convince me as a photographer, with my own business as a photographer, that I should advertise that business in a directory that was exclusively Christian businesses. It's a little hard to know exactly what would make one a Christian photographer in some marketplace terms, but Jesus being so difficult to focus on and all. I might have helped the bottom line of my business. I don't know. I didn't do it. So I'll never know. But the reason I didn't do it was because it felt like it fostered that kind of isolationism, that kind of inward-looking exclusivity that would produce this, what Dawes calls a bubble or an echo chamber cut off from the rest of the world. And that didn't feel right to me. I'm not offering this as a critique, by the way, to anyone who's made a different choice than that, but that was how it felt to me. If I only spend time with those who think and look at the world like I do, and address the things that trouble me or that stir up insecurity in me or the sense of danger in me with the same set of answers from the same set of people over and over and over again. Something is going missing that is essential. If I only read Christian books, watch Christian movies, have Christian friends, attend Christian events, I don't know, drive a Christian car, do a Christian business, they're sort of equally absurd ideas, I just end up inside this bubble. And that makes me vulnerable to the kind of loss of perspective that can turn the world into a black and white space. Kind of place where atrocity becomes justifiable because everyone that is not like me is a threat to me or to what I hold dear. And that's a problem. I could keep going down this path, but I don't want to. I think if you're here and there's resonance for this, in this for you, you already know who you are. And if there isn't, if you keep going down this path at a point pretty close to the one where we're at, it just starts to sound paranoid and foolish. In any case, I think it's not that hard to see that we only need so much of the critique before we realize that in some ways the work of seeing the problem is the easy work. What about Dawes' question? Are we doomed always to descend into barbarism? This is the way that he answers that question. The very same steps used for creating monsters can also be used to stop monstrosity. You just need to reverse the steps. Some people are born moral heroes, but most are made. And this, says Dawes, is how you make them. First, take a young man and start small. Work up to altruism and moral courage step by step. Each small thing he does to attend to the suffering of another or to stand up against injustice will make the next act feel easier, more natural. Second, give him a clear system of rules with predictable consequences. Teach him that he has the ability to make choices about his life and that these choices matter. Third, teach him that the world's problems aren't as simple as us versus them, good versus evil. Teach him that there aren't easy solutions to complex problems. Teach him to tolerate, without fear or anxiety, life's difficult ambiguity and uncertainty. And finally, to those of you, like me, who are parents of young boys, Dawes writes, teach him to seek out the other. Other clubs and groups, other sources of information, other places to see, other kinds of people, other cultural values. Spoil him with diversity so that if there ever comes a time when he is called to war, he will always remember to see the world through the other's eyes. He will fight, but he will fight against an enemy that he sees as a person like him. He will see their humanity, and in so doing, he will preserve his own. I find that equally fascinating, but on the hopeful side. Jane mentioned James and Christina's wedding, which was lovely. Christina came down down the walkway with this enormous smile on her face, and it was just so potent that. You know, I'm supposed to officiate this thing. I kind of got to try to keep a lid on my emotion, right? But I'm tearing up, and James, who never cries, Christina says she had two tears in their entire relationship. His eyes are flowing, starting to run over. It was just about this smile. It was fabulous. It was really wonderful. And they gave me, as the text for that ceremony, Colossians 3, 12 to 17. And I had a kind of an interesting experience initially because Christina sent me this email saying, this is the text that we'd like you to speak from in your meditation. And I went to look it up, and it was pretty late at night when I got that email and when I went to look it up. And so I kind of flipped open my Bible to Colossians, which is a short book. It's a letter. And I looked up the text, and this is what I read. starts at 12 to 17. So I start verse 12. Having been buried with him in baptism and raised with him through your faith in the power of God who raised him from the dead. And I'm thinking, huh. Well, sure not Corinthians. I better keep going because maybe this gets to the nugget, right? When you were dead in your sins and in the uncircumcision of your sinful nature, God made you alive with Christ and he forgave all your sins and canceled the written code, and it goes on about circumcision and so on and so forth. I'm thinking, is there something we didn't talk about in this pre-marriage conversations that I'm now supposed to, you know, illuminate from this text? Or what's... Anyway, as it turns out, you know, chapter 3 follows chapter 2 and there are two columns side by side and I just stopped my eyes in the wrong column. That's chapter 2. Thank God. So I didn't speak about that. But anyway, here is the text, though, that they gave me. So chosen by God for this new life of love, dress in the wardrobe God picked out for you. Compassion, kindness, humility, quiet strength, discipline. Be even-tempered. Content with second place, quick to forgive an offense. Forgive as quickly and completely as the Master forgave you, and regardless of what else you put on, wear love. It's your basic all-purpose garment. Never be without it. Let the peace of Christ keep you in tune with each other, in step with each other. None of this going off and doing your own thing. And cultivate thankfulness. Let the word of Christ have the run of the house. Give it plenty of room in your lives. Instruct and direct one another using good common sense. And sing your hearts out to God. Let every detail in your lives, words, actions, whatever, be done in the name of the Master Jesus, thanking God the Father every step of the way. Well, okay, so that now, you know. Now I know why I'm supposed to be here. If you do choose, by the way, and this just sort of happened this morning. I've been chuckling to myself ever since. If you do need to go to the washroom and you go to the one that's closest to the outside of the building, so our left-hand washroom, and you'll notice if you're in there frequently, weekly, that the walls have been scrubbed and so the blackboards are all clean and they have fresh stuff on them. And right at the very top of the blackboard wall, that's this wall when you're in there, is, and regardless of what else you put on, wear love. It's your basic all-purpose garment. Never be without it. Anyway, honestly, sometimes you just kind of go, okay, I don't get it, but that's lovely. So somebody had the same thought. There's a very interesting kind of congruence between this text and what Dawes is talking about. Because the things that Paul writes about to the Colossians are small things. They're ordinary things. They are things like compassion, which is understanding or empathy for somebody else's suffering and connected to a desire to alleviate that suffering. Things like kindness, which of course we've talked about this before here, but it has as its root word kin or family, kindness, the sense that we're in this together. What I do impacts you, what you do impacts me. And because we are kin, we need kindness. We need to be kind if we're going to know love. Humility, which is basically just keeping our heads straight about how we ain't all that. Gentleness, which is strength that's not being noisy about its existence. It's quiet, but it's no less strong for that. Discipline, which is doing what we know needs to be done even when we don't feel like it, being even-tempered, being content with second place. And what the writer of the letter is saying to the community to whom he writes is, these ordinary things, these small beginnings, layered together, become the thing that we call love. And the thing that we call love is the thing that opens into the path to the thing that we call peace. Now think about what Dawes is researching and writing about. And think about his conclusion about how monsters are unmade. Start small. See the congruence? See how deeply consistent what he's encountered in his research and reflection on this is with the ancient wisdom of this sacred text. Isn't that interesting? For me, as a follower of Christ, those kind of congruences are very encouraging. We have this conversation in our house fairly often when we bump into science new science stuff, which is just that science once again proved the obvious. Because every once in a while you encounter this, right? Huge study, thousands of subjects over a long time, so we have a substantial, dependable scientific base for these conclusions that we've published in this recent paper, and you read the conclusions and go, that sort of sounds like something my grandfather said. You know, like it almost folk wisdom, right? But substantiated by, legitimated in our cultural setting by all of this research. Science proving the obvious. Well, Dawes isn't necessarily claiming the label of science for his work. But when you take it in the context of the wisdom of this sacred text, it might be fair to say that what he writes proves the obvious. What he has learned proves the obvious. At least up to a point. And then it stops. And the point where it stops is when it comes to what I would call ultimate assumptions. And in this particular case, it's drawn to a stop by the assumption that war is inevitable. And the question is, will we descend into barbarism in it or not? That is an enormous question and set of questions. It's a huge topic. We're not going to dig into that very far today. But it's a really interesting departure from what I would understand to be the way of Christ. The way of love, Paul says, in this text, is also the way of peace. Not the way of systematically, incrementally reduced barbarism, as significant as that is, but the way of peace. I wonder if you've ever noticed how this happens in the media. We have enormous, unspeakably huge banks of images to work with in our communication and our culture. They're getting bigger and worse, is the trend, speaking as an image maker. Because everybody thinks they're a photographer now. Because doesn't this thing that fits in my pocket take a picture? Anyway. One of the things that is a result of that enormous bank of images is that we can draw from it whatever we want that will reinforce the point we wish to make. One of the things that was interesting in our house, which is a house full of people who like to cycle, and so we've paid this kind of moderate attention to the rise and fall of Lance Armstrong, is that when Armstrong finally was forced to at least face the facts that suggest that he's been duplicit in much of this denial of cheating, the reaction from Americans in particular, because that's his culture and country and so much of the pride in his accomplishment was rooted there, the reaction against him was incredibly aggressive at a number of points. And one of my kids made the observation that it was very intriguing to see how the images of him offered to us by the reporting media changed. And that suddenly there seemed to be this huge bank of images of Lance Armstrong looking like an asshole. You know? That apparently wasn't there before. I don't know. They didn't make it out of the edit file onto the "we could use this" file, that's for sure, because it was strained, intense, absolutely, but victorious, upright, a champion, and all of a sudden, there's this huge wash of images of a jerk. Isn't that interesting? Now that's, again, unless you're Lance Armstrong and dealing with the ripples of the suffering from that, which are legitimate and enormous. What about a story that's closer to what we might call a brutal atrocity? What about the Boston bombings? I don't know if you noticed this, but in North American media, the photographs of the surviving younger brother, almost all, the most predominant image, was almost always cut off right about here. The UK media, a little farther from the agony of the story, used that same picture, BBC, fairly prominent agency, used that same image, but they cropped it different. And in their crop, it cut off about here. And what went missing in this crop that was present in this crop was the fact that that person was wearing a suit with a rose in the lapel. It's very nicely dressed. It's hard to believe that a person who would take the trouble to wear that clothing
could be a monster. It's way easier to believe that without the suit and the robes. Way easier. Isn't that interesting? I can't be too causal about these things. They're speculative. But I think some of the speculation is interesting, and I think some of it's reasonable, and it points to something, at the very least. It points to the fact that when we think, when we allow our imagination about the moral universe to be shrunk to the size of binary, of either or, the potential for atrocity shifts. Because we are placing our moral imagination in a framework where there are too few choices. We are eliminating an enormous realm of good possibility. It's a complicated realm. It's a gray realm. It's not a black and white realm. It's ambiguous. It's filled with tension. It's even filled with anxiety. And some of us, God knows, have enough anxiety in our lives that anything that might provoke more feels like it's just bad news categorically and we should retreat. But what if? What if learning to live with that ambiguity, not least of all as people of faith, and of faith that there is a way that we can follow that is the path of love and peace, what if learning to live in that space is precisely the thing that we're here to do? I find it really intriguing that right before the portion of the Colossians text that we read this morning, Paul, writing to the Colossians, writes, here, on this way of living like Christ, there is no Greek or Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, barbarian, Scythian, slave or free, but Christ is all and is in all. Now that's interesting. In other words, there is an ultimate thing behind the thing that we're talking about that is missing when we conclude that war is inevitable or that the best we can bring to the world in which we live is the reduction of barbarism in war. Dawes is right. We need a bigger understanding of the other. We need the ability to live with the gray, with the ambiguous, without fear. Those ideas set us on the trajectory of love and peace. They just don't carry us quite far enough. And maybe that's because, if we think about this in a linear way, in a sequential way, maybe that is because the next step requires belief in something so other that we dare not make any assumptions about how that idea is going to land with other people. Because really, the idea at its heart of those next steps, the belief at the heart of those next steps, is the belief that without death, life cannot come. It's the idea that without the donation of self, we can't actually get past the limitation of the best we can do is the reduction of barbarism. It's such a crazy, radical, staggering idea that if I was Dawes and I wanted to sell the book Evil Men, I wouldn't put it in there either. Even if I believed it. Not if I really wanted to sell the book. It's just too crazy. Some of us in this community were raised with the legacy of the Anabaptists. Some of you were raised in that legacy in a more intense way than I was, and you could unpack the beliefs of pacifism that characterized that community way more lucidly than I can. But even my limited exposure to that way of thinking and to that piece of history is compelling to me, because part of my legacy is that I come from a group of people who, when faced with the moral ambiguity of war, something which they collectively did not believe was either right or inevitable, were so convinced that killing one another was not the path to peace that in this country, what they did is they went to the Canadian government and essentially said, we love our country, we don't want to abandon her in this time, we don't want to leave her without our participation in meeting the need of the country. We also don't believe in killing other people. It just doesn't fit with our understanding of the way to peace. So go ahead and put us in harm's way along with everybody else in this conflict. We're okay with being on the front lines. But would you please give us the roles that bring life and not death? Would you make us the medics? Would you make us the people who feed the hungry, who care for the wounded? Whether that's a wound of body or soul, would you give us the roles that allow us to offer compassion and kindness and gentleness? Would you please put us in harm's way such that when we stick our heads up above the rim of the foxhole of war and we look across the field of battle, we are not compelled to see the enemy, we are not compelled to see a barbarian, but we can see another creature that bears the image of the same creator that we bear the image of, and that is worthy of the same peace in their life as we want on this side of the razor wire. Could you do that? And the Canadian government said yes, and we still enjoy in this country the opportunity to be what is called a conscientious objector, somebody who wants to offer full support to their country's collective actions, but does not believe that killing the other is the path to peace, and that there must be another way to live this out. It is deeply instructive, I think, that the writer of the Colossians text is writing it from prison, where he is a prisoner. And aside from identifying his location, most of what he says to the community to whom he writes is, remember our chains. Be aware of our context when you think of us. Part of what that says to me is that these ideas, these truths, are costly ones. These are not simple, obvious, either-or sorts of ideas. We can go into that terrain when we argue for them, and sometimes we need to because it provokes our thinking, it provokes our action in ways that are needful. We need to be stirred. And sometimes the crisp drawing of this versus that can help to provoke that part of our thinking. But we have to remember that in the end, what we're digging around in here is a realm that is not like that. It's a realm that's more complex and more ambiguous and more challenging than that. And so what we're looking for, I think when we're looking for the path of peace, as people who believe that Christ showed us that path, or who are intrigued with the possibility that Christ shows us that path, is we are looking to engage in something that is not meant to produce binary clarity. It is meant to produce an orientation to this enormous challenge that life can be, this mixed thing that is our life, such that we tilt in ordinary things, small things, toward peace. We tilt toward compassion and kindness and humility and gentle strength and self-discipline and being willing to play second fiddle. We tilt that way. And the more we tilt that way, the more those layers we put on, the more we are forming about us and around us and among us and beyond us the thing that is called love. And that is the thing which has enough fortitude, enough substance to it, to help us to do the continued work of the thing that we call peace. And it is inside the thing that we call peace that we find the things that our culture says we want and need. Things like love and joy. And on the best of the days, perhaps happiness as well. Peace.